Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A few years ago, there were about 200 murders every year in Ciudad Juarez, tragic but normal for a city of its size. In 2009, there were more than 2,000 people killed violently in this city on the Rio Grande. And 2010 began in blood.
As many as 15 gunmen stormed into a party being held in a poor neighborhood in Juarez and rounded up a bunch of the kids that were partying there and just started executing them.
Juarez is now the most violent place in the world outside of war zones. Or maybe it is a war zone. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 16th. Thanks to Lynn Scherr for filling in for me yesterday.
Welcome back, Celeste.
Thank you very much. We just heard Dudley Althaus, who has been covering the city of Juarez and has seen the drastic change in that city right on the border over the past few years. It's almost startling how violent that city has become in such a short amount of time.
Our reporter yesterday said it was more violent than any place in the world, including Baghdad and Mogadishu, that's for sure.
Wow.
Let's get right to the headlines. President Obama, you can call him healthcare salesman-in-chief this week.
I'm calling on Congress to pass these reforms, and I'm going to sign them into law. I want some courage. I want us to do the right thing.
That's the president at a rally in Ohio yesterday. The make-or-break vote in the House this week is expected to be a cliffhanger, with the president working overtime in face-to-face sessions with Democrats. He tells ABC News, though, he's optimistic.
I believe we are going to get the votes. We're going to make this happen.
House Democrats triggered the countdown yesterday for the vote, with the House Budget Committee agreeing to fast-track rules for the health care reform bill, a necessary first step before a vote.
That's not the only overhaul being proposed in Washington. Senator Chris Dodd introduced his version of financial reform. It includes a consumer protection agency, and it creates a mechanism to shut down large failing firms.
When large, complex companies do fail, they will be shut down through bankruptcy or resolution, in a way that doesn't threaten the rest of our economy.
President Obama called Dodd's bill a strong foundation, but said he wants to make it tougher. Dozens of officials from the FBI, the DEA, and other U.S. agencies have joined an investigation into the killings of three people tied to the U.S. embassy in the Mexican city of Juarez. The first step is to figure out whether the murders marked an escalation in the region's drug war and who was behind it. We're joined now by Jessica Pena, a sociology professor at the University of Juarez, who's lived in the city all her life. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Have you actually had any personal experience with some of the violence going on in your city?
Yes, I have. When I was about a year ago, two young men were killed right in front of my house in a kind of middle, middle high kind of colonia in the city.
Did you know these young men?
No.
And yet you stay in the city?
Yes.
You're determined to say, well, we're going to ask you about why that is in a moment. Jessica Pena, stay with us.
So let's talk about Afghanistan now. We're learning this morning that the Afghan government was holding secret talks with the Taliban's number two, Mullah Baradar, when he was captured in Pakistan. That's a revelation. Meanwhile, police reinforcements are being sent to southern Afghanistan, where recent Taliban attacks have killed dozens. An Afghan official says more than 1,000 police are being provided to Kandahar province.
Here at home, Justice John Paul Stevens says he'll decide within the next month whether this term will be his last. The leader of the court's liberals is 89 years old. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,642, the S&P at 1,150, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,362. So our Tuesday work segment is talking about everybody who is out of work. How do you survive during troubled financial times and through long periods of unemployment like we have today? And today, we're going to get some advice from our elders. That's later on in the show. But we're asking you, too, for your tips. What financial lesson from your parents is actually helping you now? Is any of that advice not past its expiration date? Give us some wisdom at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, Ciudad Juarez, one of the most violent places in the world.
Imagine a place where it is so violent, so dangerous, that you have to bring bodyguards with you to enjoy a salad at lunch. Well, that's the situation in Ciudad Juarez.
Last week, I took my wife down to Juarez to a restaurant, but about an hour or so afterwards, there was a lot of Mexican executives coming in with their bodyguards. So we started feeling a lot better because there was, must have been about 10 bodyguards all over the place.
That's Jose Contreras. He works for the Mexican Chamber of Commerce in Ciudad Juarez. The violence there took a new turn this weekend when three people affiliated with the U.S. consulate were gunned down. Two of them were U.S. citizens. One of them was pregnant. Now Juarez residents are battening down the hatches. Many of them are fleeing the city. We're joined again by Jessica Pena. She's one of those residents, but she is not fleeing. She's a professor of sociology at the Autonomous University of Ciudad Juarez, and she's lived there nearly all her life. And I'm wondering, Jessica, have you actually made changes to your daily routine because of what's been going on?
Oh, yes, we do have to make, you know, kind of an arrangement, not huge changes, but you have to be very much more aware of where you're going. How late are you in the street? You know, you're aware of your surroundings, of the people around you. And for your children, we do have to make, you know, a little bit of adjustments, like when dropping them to school or picking them up from school. We do have to be careful. But basically, we have been trying to get a normal life going on.
Well, the economy in Juarez is suffering from this uptick in violence as well. Business owners are being terrorized by extortionists who are supposedly connected with gangs there. Well, let me play again something from Jose Contreras from the Mexican Chamber of Commerce.
Some people have gotten killed because they don't want to pay money. I know a small little bar in Juarez that is basically a dead bar now, business-wise. They sold $650 in 1 month, and yet they're having to pay $40 every 2 weeks protection money or extortion money, whichever way you want to call it.
So let's bring in Sarah Yana now. She's the Latin American Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and she's just returned from Juarez. Sarah, what did you hear from the business people there?
Right. I mean, the extortion has just gotten worse and worse. You think it might be hard to find somebody, but really any person you go up to who's willing to speak to you will share a story about extortion. I talked to one small business owner there who runs a restaurant, and he said that for months they were calling him, you know, demanding monthly money, and he just said, you know, he just ignored them, and he cut out his phone line instead. And then they showed up in December, basically with a gun, and said, listen, you have three options. You either pay, your place gets burned down, or you're dead.
Jessica Pena, listening to this and knowing that there's been this sort of mass exodus where people are leaving Juarez, they're going into El Paso, Texas. You said you're seeing for sale signs all over your neighborhood. You said two young men were killed in front of your house. And you even told us that your mother and father were both victims of attempted extortion. So why are you staying in Juarez?
Well, first of all, because it is very hard to find jobs somewhere else. Let's say if something, you know, if it came up to that point, well, then we would make that kind of decision. But basically, my husband and I, we are very attached to our city. He was born also here. Our children are being raised here. And we believe that this situation is an opportunity for us to do something, you know, something else. We need to find answers about what's going on. And both of us, you know, as being professors at the university, we need to do something more. So we are going to try to stay here in Juarez. We have talked about this to try and help the community in bringing, you know, change into the city, which is one of the things that we are trying to demand.
Jessica, you know, I really admire you and what your husband and you are doing. But how do you explain to your children who the target is here? I mean, you say you rush to pick up kids from school. You rush through your routine to make sure you don't get in the line of fire. Do you have any idea who the target is in your day-to-day life?
No, and that's one of the hardest parts. Everyone is exposed to this kind of violence. Anyone has, you know, it could be you next. So the other thing that we try to do is be aware, like I said, about our surroundings, and we do talk to our children. My oldest son, he's 7 years old, and he's in an elementary school now. So he is aware of what's going on. It's sad for us to have to tell him, you know, about these things, you know, to have to explain to a very young child about what's going on. But he is aware of that. And, you know, mm-hmm. we just pray, you know, that everything is going to be fine every single day.
Sarah, let me ask you, the Mexican President Felipe Calderon is in Juarez today, and he's actually there. He'd planned this trip before these shootings over the weekend of members, workers from the U.S. consulate. He's actually there responding to the massacre in January of high school students. What is he saying about the situation in Juarez?
Well, that's right. The massacre in January is really a tipping point in Juarez. That's when people really started to demand change, saying that, listen, this military strategy alone is not working. So Calderon, his administration has really shifted tactic here. They're not going to back, you know, they're not going to withdraw the military. I mean, that's not on the table. But what they are saying is we need to invest in social programs. They are acknowledging that, you know, they have to attack the root of the violence and not just the violence itself. So they're making all kinds of promises right now to get more people with universal health care coverage, to build high schools, to, you know, put more money into addiction programs, to give microcredit to people. It's called We Are All Juarez, and it's, you know, this is Calderon's third visit to the city since the massacre in January. And, you know, people are encouraged in Juarez. I'd also say there's a lot of skepticism that this might just be a lot of empty promises. So it remains to be seen what's going to be done.
Are there worries from the U.S. side of the border that with this mass exodus of people into El Paso that the violence will follow them across the U.S. border?
At this point, I don't think that they're thinking the violence is going to come into the U.S., but there's just concern about what they're seeing on the other side, and so many people have lives on both sides of the border.
And Jessica, quickly, with the Army on patrol, have you seen a change? Do you feel safer since the Army began patrolling Juarez?
No. We are just exposed, you know, to, I think, more violence in terms of also having gunmen, you know, on the streets. You know, my young child, he had never seen a full life gun in his life. But, you know, 2 months ago, you know, one of the soldiers came up to us as we were going to school, you know, just to ask us how we felt, you know, in our colonia, in our street.
And he was
armed.
And
for the first time, he saw it. So that's, okay. You know, contradictions for us.
Professor Jessica Pena, professor of sociology at the University of Ciudad Juarez. We also spoke with Sarah Miller Yana. She's the Christian Science Monitor's Latin American Bureau Chief. It's now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
There's a new Senate bill. It would give the government the power to break up firms that threaten the economy. It would force the financial industry to pay for its failures and create an independent consumer watchdog. The bill was unveiled yesterday by Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd.
Never again should the American taxpayer be asked to write a check because of an implicit guarantee that the federal government will bail out a company when it collapses would threaten the stability of the economy as a whole.
The bill falls short of the ambitious restructuring of financial regulations wanted by President Obama. It's coming down to the wire on health care. The president says he believes Democrats will come up with the votes to pass the reform bill this week. He tells ABC News,
"This is not a problem I chose. This is a problem that is there. We've got to start now. If we don't start now, it's going to be too late."
Vote is expected to be very close.
Middle East envoy George Mitchell has delayed a visit to Israel as tensions remain high over Israel's house-building program in East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, hundreds of Palestinians have clashed with police this morning as Israel reopened a synagogue near one of Islam's holiest sites. A reconstruction conference for Haiti will open later today in neighboring Dominican Republic. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says it's part of a wider international effort.
At the end of this month, there will be a donors conference co-hosted by the United States and the United Nations in New York to obtain pledges for work for this reconstruction effort.
The reconstruction plan for Haiti is estimated at nearly $14 billion. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, California's out-of-control Prius man. Remember him? Was it a PR nightmare for Toyota or was it made up? We'll talk about it in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now for our first takeout, we're going to take a little time out for some values. Our series, The Value, looks at how people have changed their financial and personal priorities in the face of a tough economy. When money is tight, do other things have more value to you? Takeaway correspondent Farai Chidea joins us with the story of the one person she's met from California. Farai, I know you especially like people who have chosen some unusual solutions in life, people who find a way to live frugally but still find some kind of creativity in their lives. And you found someone who's done that.
Oh, absolutely. Her name is Doreen Gunard of Sausalito, California. I met her at this book reading, and she told me that not only did she manage a houseboat harbor, but she had sailed around the globe with her family. So on a recent trip back to the Bay, I visited her at the place that she lives and works. It's called Galilee Harbor. It's an artist and maritime community, and in pricey Sausalito, it's also an affordable housing community. Doreen told me all about it as she gave me a tour.
Well, we've got a bit of everything here, which is really nice because it makes for a variety of not only vessels but also people.
And as for vessels and people, Doreen lives on this boat called the Imani with her husband Mark, who is French, their 16-year-old son Tristan, and they also have an older child named Maya who graduated from college and lives in Massachusetts now. But Mark and Doreen actually raised their son and daughter on the boat, and it was not always easy. Mark told me a little bit about that, too.
I mean, it was hard for a daughter, for example. She used to tell me, your dream is my nightmare. I hate you. Okay, that's my dream. And Doreen joined, and I made it clear from the beginning of our meeting that I was a sailor, and I didn't have the boat yet, and I had been delivering boats and being a captain before. And that will not change. Okay, so if we wanted to have a family and really travel and be together, then one day a boat will come and we will live on the boat and we will travel extensively.
So dealing with the moody then teenage kid who tells them that they hate them, I mean, most people have recognized
exactly.
That. That's not the biggest thing they face, though.
Oh, no. In 2004, they were taking this massive trip around the world. They were sailing from Oman towards Eritrea and they were chased by pirates.
They couldn't catch us. They did pursue, and there were two boats chasing us, and then it got down to one boat because they are full of people. And, you know, and they couldn't go so fast. They were laden with folks. And so finally, they're chasing, one boat is chasing until black smoke starts coming out of the back of it. And that's when they diverted off.
Okay, that's only fun when you watch it, you know, on the news or something. That's not fun in real life. But, you know, Sausalito is extremely expensive. I mean, and you're living on a boat that these guys... They probably are rich, right?
Nope. They built their own boat, the same boat they live on today. It's not really large, but it's really beautiful. They homeschooled their kids. And Doreen told me that living at sea can mean saving money compared to most people's day-to-day lives.
When you leave here, your expenses go down tremendously. There's no more car. There's no more car insurance. There's no more rent. There's no more... you know, the movies and all the things that you spend your money on are, you know, the dry cleaning is gone. It's over.
I imagine that we could all try to live that way. You could live like you were on a boat. Maybe you'd save a little money, right, Farai?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a place for everything and everything in its place.
Well, you'd have to. You can't really make a mess on a boat. As always, our series, The Value, you can go online to see more of it. You see video of Doreen Gunard and her family and their boat on thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Farai.
Thanks, Celeste.
So they're famous for economic downsizing there in Sausalito, that's for sure.
Are they? Back,
oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Living in buses, VW buses, sure, back in the 60s. Anyway, our next takeout, let's hear a familiar voice. This is attorney John Gomez. He represents that California driver, James Sykes, who has the out-of-control Toyota Prius we've been hearing so much about. Here's the attorney.
There's a ghost in these Toyota systems. There's a ghost in the machine that doesn't leave a trace. You can't replicate it. That's the problem. It doesn't prove anything.
The ghost is apparently responsible for how Sykes, in his Prius, took an unexpected 94-mile-per-hour joyride, even though he claims he was slamming on the brakes. Highway patrolman had to stop the careening Toyota by putting his own patrol car in front of it and braking for both of them. It's prompted an investigation by the Japanese automaker Toyota, who says it's currently unable to find this ghost that the attorney is talking about. Joining us is Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. This is a curious, puzzling kind of dilemma for Toyota. On the one hand, this looks a little outlandish. But on the other hand, if it's true at all, Toyota cannot afford to be wrong.
That's right. Toyota has to take this seriously. And remember, whether or not it's true that James Sykes' car flew out of control, the concern comes from a true problem that has been lingering in Toyota cars with their accelerator pedal and the brakes. But the company came out very strongly yesterday. They did not say that James Sykes was lying. But they said their examination showed that if he just put the brakes on, the car would have stopped.
And even our listeners, when we were reporting this last week, sent in some comments saying, why didn't the guy put it in neutral just to take the car out of gear? You bonehead.
A lot of people are skeptical. You also have the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration saying They may never know what happened, that they cannot determine how this would have happened, that he would have been able, you know, not able to stop mile after mile. So there's a lot of skepticism over the incident. Now, he has said he does not plan to sue Toyota. So it raises a lot of questions about, you know, if this didn't happen, why would he be saying it happened? It's kind of like those things that happen to all of us when, you know, your AC isn't working, and as soon as you call the mechanic, he says, oh, you know, you just got to push here. So it seems like there is an unexplained aspect of this.
Although he didn't just call the mechanic. He called, it seemed like, CNN and, you know, the Associated Press and the, you know, the immediate universe.
There's a lot of attention, but, you know, the media and the public is really seized on this story. There's another woman in New York who had a problem running into a wall, and everyone's curious about that. So there is a receptive audience for stories like this about your
indeed.
Toyota.
All right, Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, talking about a dilemma for Toyota. If it's true or not, Toyota has to take it seriously. Coming up, if the story about a government official hiring private contractors to track and kill militants sounds like something out of a spy novel, imagine how Frederick Forsyth must feel. He's the author of espionage thrillers like Day of the Jackal. He joins us in just a moment with his take on the big story that broke yesterday in The New York Times out of Afghanistan. Coming up, the markets will be digesting the bill that Christopher Dodd, the chairman of the Banking Committee, actually unveiled yesterday on financial regulations. Is it enough? Is it too much? We'll talk about it in just a moment with Todd Zwillick. But right now, let's check in on top news stories that about 30 minutes after the hour, a feud between the U.S. and Israel appears to be worsening. U.S. Mideast envoy George Mitchell has delayed his latest peace mission to the region. This comes after Israel vowed to keep building in disputed East Jerusalem. The State Department says it's waiting for Israel to show its commitment to reviving peace talks with the Palestinians. Meanwhile, masked Palestinians are clashing with Israeli soldiers in the West Bank this morning. In Afghanistan, our partner, The New York Times, is reporting that General Stanley McChrystal, the top NATO commander in the country, has brought more of the American Special Forces operations under his direct control for the first time. He says the move should help reduce civilian casualties. Here at home, the Army is revamping basic training for the first time in three decades in response to feedback from veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Gone are the five-mile runs and bayonet drills. In their place are the kinds of stretches and bent leg raises you might find at a gym. Trainers hope the switch will better prepare soldiers for the pace of modern combat. Drill sergeants say they also need to toughen up recruits who are more used to Facebook than fistfights.
It's make or break week for health care reform, where hopefully there'll be no fistfights. President Obama is doing everything he can to round up enough votes in the House to pass the bill. He tells ABC News.
The question is, if we don't start now, then it won't be in place 3, 4, 5 years from now. And then we'll be waiting another decade or another 15 years or another 20 years to actually take on this problem.
A vote is expected later this week. And we have new members now of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Last night's 25th annual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony welcomed Genesis, who you're hearing right now, also reggae singer Jimmy Cliff, the Stooges, the Hollies, and the Swedish band ABBA. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are up, though. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,642. The S&P opens at 1,150. And the NASDAQ at 2,362. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So Wall Street futures are up. Does that mean the markets are digesting the bill from Chairman of the Senate Banking Commission, Christopher Dodd, and saying, this will never pass? Or are they saying, this is the best thing we've ever seen? Christopher Dodd, as expected, unveiled a financial regulation bill that he hopes to get by even Republican opposition, a Democrats alone financial regulation bill. The president suggests it's maybe not tough enough. But what was in the bill, Louise Story, financial reporter for The New York Times?
The bill had a lot of things in it, but perhaps the most surprising were that the Consumer Protection Agency was put inside the Fed as opposed to being a standalone agency, which is what the president wanted. There's also some derivatives regulation. You have to clear some of those tricky financial instruments across an exchange.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Mm-hmm. You have said on this program a number of times that there are trillions and trillions of dollars in derivatives that are simply out there in this casino that has no regulation whatsoever. What fraction of those might be reined in to some kind of a corral here?
It's a relatively small amount because it's the ones that are standardized. And you can bet that Wall Street will focus on creating ones that are less standardized, that don't have to be cleared if this goes through. And that's why you're seeing not many jitters about this reform. You know, it has some changes, but they're not huge changes. The worst things that banks feared haven't happened. And then there's a feeling that it might not even pass. What'll be interesting will be to see whether the administration really gets out today and this week and really pushes, if it sticks its neck out to get this done.
Louise, you astutely said on this program yesterday that in some sense, because Dodd is retiring, this bill is all about how much of a captive of the industry he's regulated for all these years has he become, does this bill represent, or how much of a populist, I'm going to clean this up, does this bill represent. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, take Louise's sort of remark from yesterday and give me to me from your perspective. Looking at this bill, is Dodd someone who is trying to clean up things, or is he a bit of a captive of the industry he's regulated for so long?
It seems like a little bit of both, John. Good morning. But it's hard to say for sure. Dodd, look, Dodd is somebody who's not running again, and Dodd looks like somebody who's trying to get 60 votes, frankly. He's come out with a bill here, that has a lot of reforms in it, like Louise said, but the big one that the press was focused on is where the Consumer Protection Agency was going to be. For a long time, it was supposed to be outside the Fed. In the House bill, it's outside the Fed. The populist way to go is to have it independent and outside the Fed. And when Dodd was asked repeatedly, gee, you know, why is this housed inside the Fed if it's so independent and it's going to be such an independent actor and it's going to be so tough, why does the Fed have control over it? And he just said, because I don't have the votes. I don't have the votes for it. That's
what's
the bottom line.
What's the tradition of the Fed regulating anything? I mean, I'd heard months ago, and I think maybe Louise, you said it, that Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, didn't want this at all. He didn't want this under Treasury. So he was happy to let this go to the Fed. Does the Fed have a track record as a regulator?
I think the Fed has a track record as having sort of oversight over the banks, but one of the feelings, at least among the populists in Congress, is that the Fed's traditional role of oversight, such as it is one of sort of cozy oversight. That especially like the New York Fed chairman, as Chris Dodd said yesterday, was handpicked by the very banks he was supposed to regulate. And that's one thing that they're trying to end.
Well, let me turn up the heat here a little bit. I mean, isn't it that they just tweak interest rates and lend money secretly to banks? Isn't that right, Louise Story?
The Fed has been way more focused on making sure banks are safe and not so focused on making sure consumers are protected.
And there's nothing transparent about the Fed.
No, the Fed has resisted a lot of calls for transparency. They're still not telling us who participated in these huge, massive, hundreds of billion dollar programs that they put out. It adds up to trillions. And even while different congressmen have been calling for transparency reports, we may get some of that eventually, but it has been a big fight to get that info.
So, Todd Zwillick, is this a little bit like having the CIA regulate healthcare?
Well, maybe Louise.
Don't want to put you on the spot at all. There,
yeah,
Todd.
Right. An incredibly fair question, John Hockenberry. Maybe Louise could speak to that a little bit better than I could. But I get the cut of your question, and there is, I think, a fear of that, especially among the populists in Congress. And the populists are kind of ruling the rhetoric here because everyone's a populist now when it comes to the Fed and it comes to the big banks. They're the only industry in the country that's probably less popular than Congress.
Well, we're reporting this morning that the administration maybe wants this bill to be tougher. Any signs that the White House is going to pick this up and go run with it, maybe make it a little more, give it a few more teeth?
Well, Chris Dodd thinks and Chris Dodd knows that he is a slave to 60 votes. And I know that refrain is infuriating for people who are following the healthcare debate and any other debate. Barney Frank, who's the chairman of the Financial Services Committee over in the House, has a tougher bill. He released a positive and yet sort of tepid statement yesterday. Didn't say Dodd's bill was fantastic. He didn't say it was great. He said it was a basis for negotiations. So before it even gets to the White House, Chris Dodd and the 60 votes in the Senate are going to have to contend with Barney Frank and the populists and the liberals in the House.
And here's the senator talking. Here's the senator talking to you yesterday, right, Todd?
It's time now to make the decisions. Yes or no? Are we going to go forward? Are we going to do the things I've outlined here and suggested in this bill? I believe if the will exists, and I believe it does at this juncture, to get to yes, that we can get this bill adopted.
So, Todd, let's talk legacy for just a couple seconds here. If something in this bill does get passed, would it represent a legacy for Christopher Dodd?
It would have to, because of the tectonic nature of the financial collapse that we just faced. I mean, it was nearly a disaster, and people will remember it for a generation. So if Dodd manages to pass significant reform on the order of something as big as Glass-Steagall was that people remember now, it would be gigantic for him.
All right, Louise Story, a finance reporter for The New York Times, and Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. And one of the unfortunate results of the current economic downturn is that young people especially are having a hard time finding jobs. And it turns out that the best place to look for them to look for advice is not necessarily from their parents, but from their grandparents. And that's because the greatest generation survived at a time when there was also very high unemployment, 25%. Mm. So maybe you don't have a grandparent.
No, well, my grandparents told me stories of the Depression, that's for sure.
So did mine, actually. But we have a real-life grandparent here to help us out and give us some advice on how to survive these times. He is Dr. Harold Koblinzer, born in 1929, just months after the stock market crash, and he happens to be the father of our own Beth Koblinzer. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Fine, thank you.
So we have several tips, and if people go to our website, thetakeaway.org, you can actually see all of the tips laid out. But let's get to your first one, and that's for men. And during this economic recession, we're seeing that men are losing their jobs even in larger numbers than women. And you had a specific piece of advice for men who lose their jobs.
Yes. My father had a grocery store, and just before I was born, he lost it. And he was unemployed throughout the entire Depression. And that was a terrible experience. There were four children in our family. We moved from the West Bronx back to the East Bronx. We lived in a small, cramped apartment in the East Bronx. We only survived because my mother was a seamstress. And it was really rough on my father. Very, very difficult.
Because she was the breadwinner.
You bet. And that there's an ego involved. There's a self-image involved. Mm. And that is very, very crucial for men today who are unemployed to consider.
So you're saying to them, get over that.
You bet. You have to do that, and it has to be done. You have to set aside your pride and take any job just to get started.
My father's always said, do what you have to do, not what you want to do. We always tease him for that. That was always the mantra, do what you have to do. But he's always made that point that it's so important to do what you have to do. And if you don't get your dream job, at very least do some sort of work. Get a job.
Another important factor is that the family has to get involved and the kids have to get involved. They have to play a role in this thing. And my own experience as a child, going back to 8 years old, I was working and a lot of other different...
What was the job? What were you doing at eight?
Eight. I was working, believe it or not.
What were you doing?
Well, it was interesting. I was working... after school, I would sit in a candy store and wait for the phone to ring because nobody had phones. And they had a public phone in the candy store, and the phone would ring. I'd get on the phone and say, Mrs. Jones, I want to call you. I said, just a moment, please. I'd put the phone down, run outside, run to the apartment building, ring the bell. Mrs. Jones telephone. She'd come downstairs, go to the candy store, and I'd wait for my tip. And then there I had with candy bars and pinball machines, and I didn't spend a nickel, not a penny, because I took that money and I gave it to my mother.
Wow.
And I was conditioned to delay gratification just through that process. It was a very normal
thing. And you're
in
on the ground floor of the telecommunications industry.
And it's interesting because he used that delayed gratification, that hard-earned money that he had as an eight-year-old. You know, my parents talk about how they didn't buy furniture, real furniture, fine furniture, after, 12 years of marriage. They didn't go on vacations until 20 years of marriage. They really delayed purchasing.
Well, that's because you
things.
Used to jump on the couch all the
time. Well, that's true, too. Who could leave me?
That's a great piece of
there
advice
was no
from
impulse
our,
buying.
From a Beth,
great
our
stuff.
Own Beth Koblinzer and her dad, Dr. Harold Koblinzer. Again, you can see all five tips from her dad on the website. And Beth wrote a blog post as well at thetakeaway.org.
Thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. John Huckaberry here with Celeste Headlee. So government officials hiring private contractors, tracking and killing militants, former journalists involved. Sounds like something out of a spy novel. Well, Frederick Forsyth is with us to tell us the power of information in war zones. Straight out of the news, straight out of fiction. You decide. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at just about 48 minutes after the hour. In Mexico, FBI officials have joined an investigation into the murder of three people tied to the U.S. consulate there. They're trying to figure out why the victims were targeted. Earlier, we spoke with Jessica Pena, a professor at the University of Juarez who lives with her family in the city. She says the drug wars in the city have changed even basic daily routines like taking the kids to school.
We do have to make, you know, a little bit of adjustments, like when dropping them to school or picking them up from school. We do have to be careful.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is due in the city later today. The Roman Catholic Church in Germany, which has been rocked by revelations of child sex abuse, has suspended a priest at the center of the controversy. The story has threatened to envelop Pope Benedict, who was in charge of the Catholic Church in the city of Munich back in the 1980s.
Perhaps one of the most ubiquitous songs worldwide ever, but could there be more hits coming after Thriller from Michael Jackson? An album of never-before-released recordings, our partner The New York Times reports this morning, the estate of Michael Jackson may be about to sign a contract with Sony that's worth somewhere between $200 to $250 million. For more, we go now to BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett. Good morning, Duncan.
Good morning.
So how did they strike this deal on the estate of Michael Jackson? Who negotiated for Jackson?
Well, we don't know all the details of it yet. We're expecting a full statement from the lawyers who represent Michael Jackson's estate a little bit later on and from Sony Music International. What we do know is that they're talking about 10 projects over the next 7 years. And as you say, the figure that's been reported in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal is between $200 and $250 million. Well, that outstrips any kind of recording deal that we've seen recently, even the big deals between Jay-Z and Madonna and their record companies and live promotion companies. It's even more money than that. It's interesting, though, that we're talking about 10 projects here, because that doesn't necessarily mean 10 new albums. Indeed, it's obviously very doubtful that there's enough material for that. There probably are songs that were recorded at around the time of Thriller that could be released as a separate album of outtakes, but we could also be talking about computer games. And as we're talking quite a long time in the future here, possibly things that are going to be coming onto the market in 8 or 9 years' time, who knows what will be on offer? It may not necessarily be a new album or CD in the way that we understand it. It could be something else, perhaps connected with a mobile phone application. So this is obviously a very lucrative deal for the Michael Jackson estate. But it's also important to Sony to try to recover some of the money, because Michael Jackson effectively used Sony Entertainment as a bank, against which he borrowed a great deal of money. And when he died, he had enormous debts. So the company is very keen to make sure that they recover some of the money that they effectively lent Michael Jackson during his lifetime by getting him to pay it back after his death.
Right. Duncan Bartlett is a business correspondent for our partner, the BBC. By the way, happy birthday, Duncan. Duncan, thanks for coming and joining us on your special day. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So in a war zone where reporters mingle with military types and shady double agents, information, you might say, is the coin of the realm.
Look, I'm not telling you this to give you some fantastic scoop. I just want you to save your life.
If you let the story break, everyone will know it came from her.
Lee, I can't let a story like that just lie.
You have changed.
Guy, you can't use this.
Then you shouldn't have told me.
That scene from the film The Year of Living Dangerously was set in Indonesia in the 1980s, but it could easily have been in Afghanistan today. Reporters being tempted by contracts to become spies was part of the operation we learned about yesterday. Run out of the Pentagon, the operation used a number of private contractors, some former journalists, to stalk and in some cases kill insurgents in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We thought we'd ask our next guest about the value of information in a tense war zone, acclaimed author Frederick Forsyth, who wrote such Cold War classics as Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and more recently, The Afghan, about a Western spy operation set in Afghanistan. Good morning, Frederick Forsyth.
Good morning.
It is a pretty gray, murky area when you're a journalist, you have information, your sources are in the military, there are people who want to pay you for information. It's a pretty tempting business all the way around, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's very tempting, but from what I've heard and what I've read about this new project that apparently came from some guy in the Pentagon, I don't see it as a goer. If you want to have journalists on the payroll, a far easier way to go is to insert a professional trained agent as a journalist with the cover of a journalist, what is called in espionage the legend. meaning that he knows exactly what he's doing, and he purports to be a journalist. If you take an ordinary journalist and say, hey, become a spy, he's likely to get up dead.
Let's think back to Graham Greene, of course, the famous British author who, I believe, worked for MI6 at one time. Was he a spy inserted as a journalist, or was he a writer who turned and became a spy?
No, I think Graham Greene was merely what's called an observer. He was an amateur. He was a quasi amateur. Back in the war, a lot of people who mingled in neutral countries like Portugal with a good cover story were just simply asked temporarily to become agents of occasion. But that's not the same, and I don't think that he ever went into harm's way. Despite the Ashendon novels, I don't think that he actually ever, went into harm's way. He never went into Nazi Germany or something like that. You're talking about Afghanistan today. You are very, very much talking about harm's way. And we know what happened to poor Daniel Pearl. He tried to get an interview, I think, with one high up, and of course was decapitated.
And of course that happened in
business. It's much better suited to guys from the special forces, either Navy SEALs or SAS or SBS or Green Berets, or maybe CIA, but with a cover legend of, hey, I'm a journalist working for, I don't know, Farmers Weekly from Kansas or something.
Sure. That's a good one. It sounds like you're writing a new novel right there. Has technology changed this at all? These guys were running a website that had information that possibly could give up sources. Is the flow of information changed that might make it actually something that journalists could actually get involved in?
Well, the flow of information is now quite extraordinary, and technology has a massive part, a far, far greater part, for example, than when Rudyard Kipling called it the Great Game, meaning espionage along that frontier. You Americans now have amazing creatures called UAVs, like Reapers and Global Hawks and Predators, which can just simply tool up there in what's called loiter time and photograph downwards and pick up a guy many, many thousands of feet beneath, planting a mine or
right, but
a house
those drones aren't as popular with the ladies as some of the British spies in your novels.
I'm sorry?
Those drones are never as popular with the ladies as the spies in your novels.
We're talking life and death, and if these drones can see a Taliban planting a landmine, that's a useful piece of information because you then take out him and the landmine. The other thing that special forces can do, which I don't think the amateurs can do, is call in, if they get into trouble, call in an airstrike. They can call in an F-18 or an F-16 or even an A-10 Thunderbolt. They can call in a Hawk to get them, or a Black Hawk to get them the hell out of there. They can talk to Air Force Base Creech in Nevada, which is watching on TV screens what the photographic image is being taken by the UAVs. They can do a whole range of things. I don't see why anyone really wants to substitute what is basically amateurs at four times the price of professionals.
Well, Frederick Forsyth describes this operation reported in the New York Times yesterday as a bunch of amateurs, as you describe the radical revolution in technology, both on the weapon side and the information side. Frederick Forsyth, thanks so much for being with us.
If we decided to employ a professional...
You have to employ a professional. Your organization is so riddled with informers that nothing you decide is a secret for long.
No, the job would have to be done by an outsider. The only question that is by whom and how much.
Will you do it?
Yes.
How much?
You must understand that this is a once-in-a-lifetime job. Whoever does it can never work again.
How much do you want?
$500,000.
What?
In cash. Half in advance and half on completion.
$500,000 French
dollars.
It's from the movie Day of the Jackal. Authored by our last guest.
You can actually hear that entire conversation again if you want to at our website, thetakeaway.org. And we're also asking you for day to tips, not about spies or espionage, but about finances. We're looking for your tips on what kind of financial lesson still holds true for you today, something that your parents taught you, or if you have wisdom to impart, give it to us. 8778MyTook, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org. You can also check out the Takeaway blog, where there's posts from people like Beth Kobliner and others. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is, and we're not spies, The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.